Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. The thoughts and opinions I express in this podcast are mine alone and don't represent those of my employer. So a lot of things have happened since the last podcast about 2 weeks ago. One of the most interesting, in my view, is the HIPAA rule that was released. Most people who are familiar with HIPAA knew that the Department of Health and Human Services had been scheduled to release what was called the Mega Rule. And that came out last week. It's 563 pages long. One of the most interesting things I think that's in the law is that it directly ties business associates or companies who are not directly responsible for protected health information, such as a vendor or a contractor, somebody you wouldn't normally think associated with HIPAA. They're now on the hook to comply with HIPAA rules if a covered entity like a hospital, a doctor, an insurance company outsources certain functions to them. So this really dramatically expands the scope of who needs to care about HIPAA. I don't think it's directly tied into this bill. I haven't had a chance to read all 563 pages yet, but there is a provision that Health and Human Services is going to start auditing firms for HIPAA compliance. And one of the interesting things is it's intended to be cost neutral, which means they're going to fund themselves based on fines. So I think we can kind of imagine what kind of situation that's going to bring up. So I was fairly curious as to what kinds of security incidents led to the majority of data loss or protected health information data loss. And I headed over to datalossdb.org and did some poking around. I was really surprised to find that the majority, I'll say the vast majority of data loss incidents are related to stolen laptops, stolen USB drives, and lost USB drives. There's very few incidents of hacking or improper use by inside employees. They're definitely there, but I would say it's a couple of order of magnitude less than just the dumb old spreadsheets of people sitting around on a workstation or a USB drive, unencrypted, being lost or stolen. All right, the next thing I want to talk about is Java. It's been a tough couple of weeks, actually probably more truthfully, a tough couple of months for Java. There were a couple of 0 days back at the end of 2012, and we just had another 0 day within the last couple of weeks, and that induced a lot of panic. We know that this particular Java bug was being exploited in the wild pretty commonly. It had been added into Metasploit, and there was evidence that it was being used in Black Hole and Cool and some of the other exploit kits. Then last weekend, Oracle surprised everybody with their relatively rapid response and released Java 7 Update 11. However, what was kind of interesting, contrasting with other releases, the furor of people criticizing Java didn't really subside. We had the Department of Homeland Security and US CERT continuing their calls for people to disable Java in their browsers, which, by the way, is excellent advice. It just doesn't work for most companies, at least most companies who rely on Java as part of their business application set. Some astute people pointed out that even if you do disable the browser plugin for Java, after you update Java to the latest version, the browser plugins get re-enabled. And that is particularly important because within about 2 or 3 days, we had two different sources claiming that even the new version of Java actually is vulnerable to exploits. Brian Krebs reported that he saw a couple of transactions for about $5,000 each purchasing a 0 day that was applicable to version 7, update 11. And the other one was the fine people at Security Explorations reported that they did some analysis and found two additional zero-day bugs in Java 7 Update 11, which they've reported to Oracle. This is where it kind of gets tough. I've seen a lot of people online over the past couple of days saying, oh, Java, what a f***ing joke. Can you believe people actually run that shit? And you know what? It is a little surprising and discouraging that so many people have become so entrenched with it, but the reality is companies have made a big investment in it, and it's not palatable in most cases for a security guy to come in and say, you know what, we're going to rip out Java because it just won't work. It might be a good idea, but beyond a strategy statement of over a period of time moving away from client-side Java, it isn't going to happen fast. So we've got to figure out what can be done to mitigate the risk. And there are a couple things that can be done, but none of them are great. You know, the advice to uninstall Java altogether, in my view, really only works well for home users. And even at that, it only works for home users who don't have kids that like to play Minecraft. It certainly won't work in probably the majority of larger organizations who have developed legacy applications that use Java. You know, all of this somewhat negates the somewhat intricate fact that the situation is a little bit worse in many cases with client-side Java in organizations where certain business applications only run on specific versions of Java. And so they're somewhat stuck on some old version and have very limited options to move forward without some huge development investment. As I mentioned, another really good idea for most people, again, mostly applicable to home users in my view, is to disable the browser plugin for Java. That is even problematic for a couple of reasons. You know, number one, after you install the update, the browser plugin's going to get re-enabled. But the other is that a lot of the business applications that used client-side Java are going to be based on intranet websites. And so if you disable the browser plugin, you're going to have to go through and do some kind of re-engineering of your application, basically how that application gets started up. So we're left with relatively few things that can be done to mitigate this. Probably the best, in my opinion, is to use something like NoScript, which lets you specify what domains you'll allow Java to run on. And in that case, you would be able to say, I want to allow Java to execute on my intranet domain zone, but nowhere else. The downside there is, you know, number one, it's somewhat easy to turn off or uninstall NoScript. And the other is that NoScript is only available in Firefox. So what about Internet Explorer, Chrome, Opera, Safari, and on and on? There is a similar tool for Chrome called ScriptSafe, but it's really not as nice and configurable as NoScript. Another good idea is to configure one browser with the Java plugin and other browsers without it, and the browser with Java is only for use on the intranet networks. It's a good idea, but again, unless you have some kind of technical enforcement that determines very specifically which browser can be used for which zones, people generally are going to pick one browser that works everywhere and use it to do everything. And again, every time a Java update comes out, you're back to having to reset the environment again. Another idea that I really liked, but is not achievable in many places, is to implement some filtering policies on corporate proxies. This would, for instance, let you not allow Java calls outside of the corporate network. And again, the downside is if you have people that take their computer home and aren't forced through your company's network, they could get compromised that way. So there aren't really any great solutions to this. I'm interested in hearing if anybody has any other good ideas. You can post them down below in the comments. Well, there's one more thing I want to rant about for a second, and that's one of the great things about having a podcast of your own is you get to rant about whatever you want, and that's antivirus. Before you turn off your player, I'm probably not going to say what you're expecting. Right now, there's a lot of antivirus bashing happening out in the industry, and honestly, it's kind of deserved. We saw in the aftermath of some of our, quote, APT attacks over the past couple of years, some of the AV vendors come out and be somewhat conciliatory and recommend that antivirus companies do better in general at protecting their clients. But most of the criticism I see is that antivirus isn't a perfect solution, and therefore, what real value does it have? It provides a false sense of security that people believe they are somewhat invincible when they're on the internet and don't need to be careful. And I do think there is definitely an aspect of that. But that doesn't take away from the fact that it is actually a valuable control. Look at your antivirus console logs. How many viruses does it find across your enterprise? I bet it's quite a few, and it's really going to be proportional to how many endpoints you have in your environment. So every one of those viruses that were detected and blocked by your AV are probably one less headache that you didn't have to deal with. So yes, viruses are getting through all the time because they're not detectable, but for those that are, which by volume probably constitute more than are not detectable, it's a worthwhile control. There is another aspect of utility to antivirus that I think a lot of people overlook, and that's in incident response. So if you consider that, yes, antivirus is an imperfect solution, it won't detect everything that comes by, your systems are still vulnerable, your people are still going to click on something that will get their system compromised. But once that does happen, and you do go into an incident response mode, antivirus becomes a fairly important thing for you. Once you're able to track down infected systems and get copies of the malware, you can provide those to your antivirus vendor, and the antivirus vendor can go and create some detection signatures, and you can get those pushed out into your environment pretty quickly, and that will effectively help you limit the distribution and depth that your systems become compromised. So to me, that says one of the key attributes we should be looking for in determining the value that a particular antivirus vendor brings is how responsive are they when you present them with something new. Does it take them a day? Does it take them a week to take a sample that you've given them and turn that into some detection that can be pushed out into your organization? Also, how accessible are their engineers to work with you during some kind of an incident? From that perspective, I think it's probably fair to question whether the cost model that we have to pay for antivirus is appropriate, because it isn't providing us the value that maybe a lot of people think it does. But I definitely am not in the camp of saying it's a useless control and we need to throw it out because it's not perfect, and in fact it's dangerous because it leads people to believe they're invincible. You know, the reality is that people are feeling invincible regardless of whether or not they know there's antivirus there or not. One of the core problems, I think, we as an industry have to come to terms with is much of our problem stems from just bad behavior and the concept that what they're doing isn't really impacting them. And even if it were, I mean, take a look at home users. The average home computer is probably compromised worse than a business computer. They personally have things to lose on the home computer. If they're not going to do the right thing on their home computer, can you really expect them to do the right thing on the business computer where they have even less to lose? They've got a help desk that's going to come in and clean up their mess. Until we solve that problem, I think this is going to be a very challenging industry that has a lot of work for a lot of people. In any event, that's my rant for this week. I hope everybody has been enjoying the new year so far. I know it's been fairly busy for me. Anyhow, if you have any suggestions or recommendations or feedback for this podcast, how bad it sucks, whatever, please drop me a note at podcast@defensivesecurity.org. I would love to hear some feedback on what you think I'm doing well, what you think I'm not doing well, if there's something else you think you'd like to hear. I've been adding quite a few resources to the defensivesecurity.org website. If you get in there, you can find quite a lot of different security resources I personally use as part of my job and research. For those of you who have listened to the last few podcasts, I say thank you very much. We're up to about 1,000 downloads so far from somewhere in the neighborhood of 21 different countries. So thank you very much. And I look forward to talking to you again next time with some more interesting security stuff. Have a great one. Bye.